and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. This is episode 544. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, in Western New York. You're listening to Radio War Nerd. Subscribe and support the show, please, at patreon.com/Radio War Nerd. And I'm on the line with the War Nerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in Italy. John, how are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing okay. We're going to try and finish up the Byron story, the Byron in Greece story. And it's an amazing story, and it leads in so many directions that it's a shame we can't follow them all out. But I'm going to try and stick to the main line. We did a background episode. That's the first part of this story. And in that one, we dealt mainly with the context in which Byron gets himself to Greece and eventually dies at Missolonghi. And above all that context, if you can sum it up in a single word, would be reactionary. The beginning of the 19th century was an explosion of ideas of human potential that were sometimes ridiculous, but sometimes very moving and rather profound, to the point that even the wretched Wordsworth said, you know, bliss in that dawn it was to be alive. That quickly curdled, especially in England. And if you're listening to this in this language, you've probably fallen under the spell of the grim Anglo reaction, so that you're more likely to see the progressive tendencies at the beginning of the 19th century as something bad. That's just inescapable. That's just how this language has played out. Can't do much about it. But one of the few young intellects who opposed the rightward swing was the young Lord Byron and his friends, the various Shelleys. And what you're going to play out in this story is Byron as by far the most militant and the most powerful and rich of that group, fighting against a continent-wide swing to the right. So just to emphasize that, I'll deal with the Vienna Congress of 1815, which was, oh good, Napoleon's exiled to St. Helena. Now we can divide the continent up among our various royal reactionary selves. And the leading, protagonists or villains, as you like, of the Vienna Congress were a fairly horrible bunch. The leading mind was perhaps Metternich. And Metternich was one of those instinctively reactionary minds that said, let's just keep whatever we have now. Don't change a thing. And in that way, he was remarkably congenial to the British establishment, which roughly thought the same thing.
Didn't Kissinger love Metternich? Kissinger seems like the type he
absolutely, would. Absolutely. He loved Metternich. And the strange thing is, Kissinger inherited a very powerful empire. America was much more powerful when he came to power than it is now. But Metternich was the representative of Austria, a really weak power. And a lot of his scheming was designed to exploit what he could, to make up with cunning for the weakness of the power he represented. And that's why, one of many reasons that Kissinger was such a completely idiotic representative for America in the time of its prime. Yeah, when I went to UC Berkeley in the early 1970s, the lecture that was prepared for all us first years was somehow about Kissinger and Metternich. It was all about how they were representatives in two different centuries of the same brilliant, brilliant tendency. And now, looking back, I have no idea what was so brilliant about Henry Kissinger. And we've talked about that before.
Yeah, like, I know. He was a
Spangler. How did he get that rep?
Yeah.
I mean,
he reaffirmed, I don't know, he sort of, he spoke to the like bland mainstream historians in the profession, in the guild, I guess. Like, he made them think, oh, wow.
Yeah. You know, and he, well, as his brother said, he cultivated.
He reads books.
Yeah, he cultivated the scholarly German accent, which had a certain afterglow from the brilliant Germans and, well, German Jews mostly, of the 20th century. And so Kissinger's brother spoke American English with no accent at all. But, you know, Henry Kissinger...
He was a truck driver, so he couldn't, you know, or something. He had some other job where he had to speak flat American.
Yeah, Kissinger would speak in this solemn, scholarly way that vastly impressed people in the United States. And so Metternich is also, well, not... He's smarter than Kissinger, but he's not very impressive as a rule. And really, he just stands for this reactionary power, which says whatever is right. And you can't bother anything. You can't upset anything. Like, everything is on the shelf. Just leave it there. Dust it occasionally. But don't move anything. It might break. And so Metternich's partner in this horrible reactionary order was Lord Castlereagh, a British politician. Castlereagh eventually slit his throat after helping to slaughter a bunch of Irish people. And there was general rejoicing, except possibly in the elite circles of the British Empire. But both Metternich and Castlereagh were oddly fond of the Ottoman Empire. Not that they were exactly pro-Muslim, although Churchill, for example, was very pro-Muslim. It was supposedly he was about to convert, and his family had to say, no, don't do that. That would be unwise. But in their case, it was like, okay, the powers that be right now in 1815 are the ones we want to keep. We don't want any new powers coming up. We don't want any current powers disappearing. So the power to the southeast of Europe was the Ottoman Empire. So we're going to keep things that way. As Ted Hughes's Hawk says, I am going to keep things like this. I mean, Ted Hughes's Hawk, by the way, could have fit right in with the Congress of Vienna. The full quote is really beautiful, the Ted Hughes's Hawk. Nothing has changed since I began. My eye has permitted no change. I am going to keep things like this.
Oh, yeah.
That's the end of the poem. Yeah. And that was how the Congress of Vienna felt. Mm. So even though the Ottoman Empire was Muslim and semi-Asian and a lot of things that the Europeans weren't generally fond of, the European elite was determined to keep the Ottoman Empire in power. And the British Empire was particularly determined because they had this ridiculous fear that the slapstick Russian Empire could threaten their holding in South Asia, especially India. So they proposed this Congress system in which the big powers of Europe would meet periodically and manage the system, mainly just to make sure nothing changed.
A quick word about their love, and this goes on for decades, of the Ottoman Empire. As far as I could tell, they loved it because it was weak and hierarchical, and if you wanted to sell, so all you had to deal with was the guy at the top in order to cut deals, and you could make advantageous deals because they were weak and constantly decaying. And yet, you know, you had this large market that you could sort of manipulate perhaps more easily if you prop up this dying old boxer or something.
In the 20th century, the British policy toward Nigeria was very much in the line of that policy toward the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century, because the British government, though it was much weaker than it had been in the 19th century, consistently sabotaged the Biafran separatists, who were very much Christian, in favor of the Muslim generals who ran the northern Nigerian principalities, which they had always loved for exactly the reasons you described, Mark, because they were very hierarchical entities in which you could just make a deal with the top guy, mm-hmm. and that would stick forever. Whereas the Biafrans, the Igbo, were very quarrelsome people and very verbal and volatile and also spoke,
more decentralized, right?
Yeah, decentralized, yeah. English speaking, all of that stuff, entrepreneurial. That policy in British history has been pretty consistent, but it was also Austrian policy in the 19th century. It's just Austria in the 20th century was just folded into other powers and it ceased to exist as a power. So its attitudes didn't matter. Britain still mattered. The general tone of Europe in 1815, when Byron is starting to come to adulthood, and when the Greek independence movement is starting to gain force, is highly, highly hostile to any changes in the order of Europe. And the good thing about Byron, well, there are many good things about Byron. I just flat out admire Byron. And there, for some reason, people are wary of him, and I don't quite understand why. But I think he's great. And he says in the beginning of Don Juan that the last English figure he can admire is Milton. And even that is a mistake, I think, because he shouldn't admire Milton. But he does. And he compares Wordsworth to Milton very much to Wordsworth's disadvantage. And right. It's in terms of Castlereagh and by implication Metternich and the Sultan. So this is Byron describing his descent from the reactionary system of Europe. Would Milton adore a sultan? He obey the intellectual eunuch Castlereagh, cold-blooded, smooth-faced, placid miscreant, dabbling its sleek young hands in Aaron's gore, and thus for wider carnage taught to pant. Transferred to gorge upon a sister shore, the vulgarest tool that tyranny could want, with just enough of talent and no more, to lengthen fetters by another fixed and offer poison long already mixed. Okay.
That's so really good.
Byron dissents early from the reactionary consensus, and he's propelled in that descent by the fact that nobody wants him anymore in England because he has a disreputable reputation for public indecency. Now, that makes it sound like he went around doing little crotch grabs in public. That's not what
Grupinator.
I mean. He had public affairs and didn't hide them. So he is basically forced out of England. But it's not entirely uncongenial for him to be forced out because he's not very happy in England. The tone of the place doesn't suit him anymore. The proto-Victorian narrowness. There is a narrowness in such a notion, he says at one point. So Byron is pushing, figuratively and literally, as far away from England as he can get, toward the southeast, toward the less civilized portions of the continent, which include Greece at this point, whereas the rest of the continent, the elite of the continent, is trying to force the conservative turn, even on those places like Greece, which are most unhappy under Ottoman rule. So the Austrian police take a big role in this. You can, by the way, there's a movie I can recommend here, Horseman on the Roof. It's about someone who is dodging Austrian secret agents, actually who just, not even secret agents, just an Austrian murder squad, who are determined to kill any Italian or other patriot they can find. It's quite a good movie. And, you know, you wouldn't think Austrians would make good villains, but these guys are pretty scary, and they were in their time. So Byron is sort of being forced and lured and driven toward the southeast, toward Greece, and the rest of the continent is being lured toward what he would call the moral north, always northern, always westward. Even Orwell says he was raised to think that the most northerly peoples are the best, so that he always imagined that Eskimos must be the greatest people in the world. The only power which dissents to some degree from the frowning on any revolutionary tendencies in Southern Europe is Russia. And it obviously does that for its own reasons, but also because of a cultural link with the Orthodox Christian communities of Southeastern Europe, which are completely dominated by and enclosed by the Ottoman Empire. The Russian government isn't, as a rule, very sentimental, but it does tend to be a bit sentimental about their smaller Orthodox brethren in the Balkans and, to some degree, in Greece.
And the Cyrillic alphabet. Too.
And the Cyrillic alphabet, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sentimental about that because I think I mentioned when we were in Macedonia last, it's like they've given up on the Cyrillic alphabet. And it's like, oh, come on, guys. I had to learn that thing.
In Serbia, as I recall, they just had both, right? They had the Cyrillic versions and the Latin script, depending on the newspaper or something. That's how I recall it anyway. I don't know, folks.
Yeah.
I know we have some Balkan folks who are subscribers who could tell us if it's still that way, but yeah.
Well, I suppose the Turks had a pretty big wrench when they switched from Arabic right. to European script, right. which was one of Ataturk's so-called reforms. So fair is fair. But anyway, the Russians were inclined always to take the lead in intervening in Balkan and Greek affairs, and that upset the British very much, and it led to the British and their lackeys, the French, the 19th century French, they're always like, you know, crowding along with the British. Yeah, yeah, what you said. that's how the Crimean War gets started. Mm-hmm. There's a beautiful editorial cartoon of the Crimean War, which shows the Turkish Empire as a sheep with a fez on it, and a two-headed eagle is trying to lift the sheep and carry it off and feast on it. And that, of course, is the Russian Empire. Mm-hmm. And the British and the French are trying to save the sheep. Again, not because they're so sentimental about the sheep itself. They just mm-hmm. don't want the Russians carrying it off. So
that's why a big reason why they kept propping it up, because the fear that if the Ottoman Empire fell, then kind of a domino effect, but on a larger scale, right? That the Russians would dominate, and you know, it's just two steps from that to them taking over India and all that. So yeah,
yeah,
that's the paranoia anyway.
Yeah, so the Russians are in this. The Russians are in this odd place of seeming to be a more humane power than, say, the British. I mean, well, that isn't quite as much of a paradox as it yeah. might seem to some Anglos, but
upholding sort of liberal post-Enlightenment, you know, Enlightenment era ideals more, and standing for the Greeks, which, yeah. you know, who are the Bible for enlightenment and I mean like biblical characters for democracy and enlightenment.
Right? Yeah, actually the right. biblical yeah. analogy is very good. Yeah, yeah, like if you're a secular liberal,
yeah.
The classical Greeks, yeah, are your Bible, and those are your well, I don't want to push the analogy, but those are your, we better not make any of them Christ figures.
Yeah.
They're your apostles, whatever. Yeah. So the Russian Tsars are sympathetic to the Greeks, and they follow this tendency to idealize the ancient Greeks. Well, I mean, the ancient Greeks were pretty damned impressive, but also to think of the modern Greeks as their direct ancestors, except Tsar Alexander, he has his own problems. But Catherine the Great is obsessed with the Greeks and builds a replica of the Hagia Sophia at Tsarskaya Tsiala. Even though the Hagia Sophia has been in Muslim hands for centuries already. But none of these Russian rulers really intend to help the Greeks achieve their independence. They may play around with some Balkan powers, but the Greeks are too far away, too maritime, too much really under the English sphere of influence for them to mess with. But the Russians do one great thing, which is to ask Greeks to settle in their new provinces on the north side of the Black Sea, as we mentioned last time. And many Greeks do that, and they become incredibly wealthy. They're very much a mercantile people. They have that tradition, and they're under tremendous pressure in Greece and in the Ottoman Empire. But once they're released from that pressure into the Russian territories, they become incredibly prosperous within a couple of generations. So that leads to the formation of the Greek Society of Friends, Philiki Etereia, the Society of Friends, that is a secret society for the promulgation of revolution in Greece against the Ottomans. They don't get direct backing for that, but they get a lot of sentimental support from not exactly the European powers, but the educated opinion that is just below the European power system. That is, imagine that, you know, the New York Times subscribers are very much in favor of something that the American government is not in favor of. Well, you can sort of imagine that now, but that's how it is. Like the wealthy, educated Europeans are very pro-Greek, and they're very sympathetic with these Greek/Russian revolutionaries, but the governments are not. Mm-hmm. They just don't want any part of anything that seems like a revolution. This is one commentator's description of that divide. These secret Greek societies were an aspect of a fundamental feature of the politicization of European culture after 1815. The rise of mass politics through associations and societies of all kinds, most of them highly visible and perfectly respectable, yet engaged in shaping a new force that was ultimately even more threatening to Metternich and the Holy Alliance than underground radicals, public opinion.
That's so interesting. It's sort of like before the experts, as they'd call them now, the technocrats and the experts, there were just the reactionaries, which is kind of perfect, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the public opinion is a relatively recent phenomenon. I mean,
but I mean, like with the secret societies and the rise of mass politics through associations, they were in opposition to the Metternich Castle Ross system, right? And that was basically managing the world, or their world, which was, you know, Europe basically, through. I mean, today it would be managed through technocratic elites, managerial elites, experts. Then it was the reactionaries. And it's just interesting that the reactionaries were essentially replaced by the credentialed experts, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, even then, though, the reactionaries were, I don't know, they were sort of divided in some ways. Like, unless the direct interests of the power they served was opposed to radical change. Like, you know, there's a reason that Byron doesn't go to Ireland, for example, to get himself killed, because that would be directly acting against the British elite's interests. Greece is another matter. It's like it doesn't have any value that is particularly urgent to the British Empire.
Right, but it also shows up in the bankruptcy of the empire's morality, or, you know, kind of geopolitical morality by going and fighting there, because it does go against what the British want, but it's just not as existentially dear to the ruling class there.
Yeah, and in fact, they decide eventually that they will support the revolution, and it turns out to be fine as far as any threat to their power. But all the ingredients are there. Like secret organizations are like the Freemasons. In fact, they're modeled on the Freemasons, which was both an elite group of wealthy, influential men, and also in theory a revolutionary group in some places, you know, not so much in the successful empires like Britain and France, but in the unsuccessful or unpopular empires like Russia or like what used to be Greece, the Freemasons are much more radical, much more willing to countenance something like revolution. And these Greek societies are very, very much in favor of not just the freedom of Greece, but the revival of the Byzantine Empire. And that is a much bigger undertaking because you would need to conquer Constantinople, which happens to be on the Anatolian mainland, the real headquarters of the Ottoman Empire. And, you know, in 1820, for example, as we start this, the population of Greece is about a million, less than a million, actually. And the population of the Ottoman Empire is 28 million. It's a vast disproportion. So the only way they can think of to reconquer Constantinople is to do it with Russian cooperation, because the Russians also think occasionally like, huh, Constantinople, huh? Right there on the Straits. Nice place. And of course, that drives the British crazy. Like, don't you dare. Don't you go anywhere near that place. But in the meantime, the Greeks are willing to consider plots simply to free Greece proper, because Constantinople is not and hasn't been for centuries part of anything that could be considered Greece. So they're concerned mainly with freeing what is now Greece, the Peloponnese and the mainland above it. They aren't particularly effective at that, but they do have a base in Constantinople. And by 1820, their organizations are becoming more effective, targeting Russian Greeks who have the money and the tolerance of the Russian administration. Like, they, you know, the Russians are quite willing to consider letting the Greeks dream about taking Constantinople, because they're willing to cooperate with Russia as fellow Christians, fellow Orthodox people. And these are very good agents for Russia or Greece, because they're very mercantile. The Greeks are an intensely mercantile people. And once they're freed by being headquartered in Odessa rather than in cities within the Ottoman Empire, they bounce around all over. And they take to revolutionary habits easily. Code names, encrypted messages, jargon. These were already things that were used in commerce. In fact, before e-commerce was popular, codes, secret messages, all of that, they were very, very important in far-flung mercantile enterprises. Like in Venice, for example, you could have your credit line opened in a city 500 miles away. And that wasn't something that was very easy to do in say, Britain or France at the time. So they adapt all these things to codes and revolutionary codes. So they have these funny code names for other peoples, like in the Greek merchants' codes, Serbs are failures. The Italians are sweeties. The Turks are foreign residents. And the Muslim Albanians are relatives by marriage, which is perhaps, that's the best, I think.
That
you know,
is.
It's like, yeah. You know, he's my brother-in-law. Yeah. He kind of got to put it up.
If I'm reading this right, the Greek, you have it in parentheses here, is sympatheroid. It's like, must be, I guess, where we get sympathetic from.
Yep. Yeah. Like, yeah, you gotta put your arm around them. It's like, yeah. So they were already recruiting, and they drew most of their support from these merchant families in Russia who had sons who had the leisure to dream about becoming revolutionary soldiers, because, you know, that has always been a middle class dream at the very least, if not upper middle or upper class. Because if you're not at least middle class, you got to go to work. And these guys don't have to go to work. And they dream about being soldiers. So they begin to organize in military units around 1819. But the military units they organize are really nothing compared to the strength of the Ottoman forces. I mean, the Ottomans have been marching across southern Europe for centuries. I mean, they got to the gates of Vienna twice when they were pushed back. And they were a fearsome power. I've recommended before the Albanian novel, The Siege. I can't remember the author's name right now, but it's just called The Siege. And it's a really beautiful description of an Ottoman siege of an Albanian castle.
Is that Kadare? What's his name? Ismail Kadare, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, it's a beautiful novel. And it has a sense of the fearsomeness of the Ottomans in their prime, because they have various corps of soldier, and some of them are just meant to be human sacrifice, like the Janissaries are the top of their organization. But there are others who are first wave soldiers who are just designed to go in and occupy the defenders for the time and then get killed. And then the Janissaries will come in and clean up. And you get the sense that they're a terrifying force. And that and they were for centuries. They're starting to show some leaks in the 19th century. Later, they became, quote, the sick man of Europe, and Europeans affected to pity them, although there was a lot of sneering in that pity.
You've done some, you've talked about how fearsome and scary the Ottomans were, and it is. I'll post some links to some of the episodes we've done on that period, like the Battle of Lepanto that you did. That was an earlier episode, or you know, some of certainly at least one or two of the series on the Republic of Venice that we did with Annibale.
Right.
But I think it's either been in the episodes or in older newsletters. You wrote about how you can see the scars in southern Europe, or certainly like southern Italy, of the old fear of Ottoman raids in terms of castles and like forts.
There are towers along the sea on the Adriatic coast of Italy in the south. And that was because of some raids like the one on Otranto, which involved cutting off the heads of hundreds of locals who refused to convert and taking many others off into slavery. So, and yeah, this was a real fear. The Turks, as they were usually known, were truly fearsome. And they were just becoming less fearsome this way at this time. And the funny thing is now Metternich and Castlereagh are saying, come on! Be more fearsome.
Yes.
Like, come on.
It's your analogy of holding the fighter up to keep fighting again. Like, kind of,
Yeah, Jake LaMotta going, come on. Stand up. I only hit you a little. Come on. So, okay. So now let's talk about Byron. Byron grows up in this odd reactionary time, very unpleasant time for the most part. We talked about Shelley's poem 1819 in the last episode. You might want to read that again to refresh your memory of what an unpleasant time it is. The revolutionary hopes of the beginning of the century are all gone. There's a sense that we have to be a lot more prim and proper. I mean, the Reagan era, at least, it wasn't quite so prim. It was more, I don't know, it was coked up, really. But the British and Restoration French elites are very stiff and tiresome and just not very exciting. So Byron grows up as the kid of a degenerate. I mean, it just absolute degenerate. The son of Jack Byron, who was a British Army officer, and his second wife, Catherine Gordon, who was an heiress, and that's why Jack Byron married her. He didn't even try to hide it, really. And Jack Byron squandered all the money in the traditional manner and then went off to the continent and died, which was, you know, all he could do. Byron was left to be raised by his mother, who was also a drinker and stout. She was described as stout and melancholy. So your father is absent, and he's often described as a lunatic in the first place. And your mother's, you know, a kind of a fat drunk, and she yells at you a lot. And you also have at least one club foot. Byron has at least one club foot. I didn't really know what that is. I mean, I read many novels in which someone has a club foot, but apparently it's when your foot is turned on its outer edge so that you have to walk on the outer edge of the foot, which becomes incredibly painful after a while. And most people with club foot don't try to walk very much. Byron hated being any sort of invalid, so he tried to walk as much as he could. And beyond that, he swam. He was a really good swimmer. But he has a nasty upbringing for the most part. But at the age of 10, he becomes a lord. And, it's good to be a lord in Mel Brooks's terms. he goes to Harrow, that elite
school. That's because his mother is highborn, right?
Yeah. And his mother is the aristocrat in the.
I mean, it's a pretty damn unhappy home, but at least he got to be a lord,
It's better than being like a coal digger in an unhappy home, and there was plenty of that too. Mm-hmm. He goes to Harrow, which is an elite elementary school, then Trinity College at Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And he meets a lot of people who are going to be important to his later life here. And many of them are romantic passions. Byron was pretty openly bisexual, and that was really not so extraordinary in his class. There was almost an unspoken assumption that, you know, boys would be homosexual until they got out of school, and then they would marry and father about 20 children. It's very much on the ancient Greek pattern.
Yeah, I was just going to say, there's another reason to like the ancient Greeks there, or identify with them. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So he has other crushes, friends, and it's hard to tell.
Do the English acknowledge that today? Because, you know, there's still all kinds of, you know, jokes and so on about, something more like homosexual rape in elite British schools, but do they acknowledge at least that that was more of an open thing?
They always seem to acknowledge it belatedly, like in the, you know, in Evelyn Waugh, oh, it's all over the place, you know, or even in Burgess and Maclean, oh, it's all over the place. But it's never quite current, I don't think.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense.
It's always, I mean, our era will probably be in the same category. But Byron, yeah, some of these people are just friends. Some of them are not just friends. Hard to tell. But Byron makes a lot of connections, which is what Harrow is meant to do. It's not really to be studied in. Byron, as I mentioned last time, says when he mentions that Shelley had to read Prometheus and translate it from the Greek with him, that, yeah, I didn't do any of that, you know, Greek stuff in school. I was just, you know, I don't know, winking at his desk mate or whatever. And
networking in their own way.
Or as they call it, networking.
Yes. Yeah. But that is the right thing to do. I mean, that is what an elite school is for, is, I mean, to actually network, you know, and to make lifelong connections and that sort of, that is how you get ahead in life. I mean, I wish someone taught me that when I was at Berkeley, because I was more into being me against everyone.
Thing. I wish someone had taught me how to speak to other people as a commuting student at Berkeley. But anyway, yeah, he was quite good at that. He was very much the extrovert, and he was also writing. And his first poetry collection, Hours of Idleness, got savaged by reviewers and. Showing his pugilistic bent, he wrote a counter review called English Bards and Scotch Reviewers, which infuriated a lot of people, which greatly pleased Byron. Because one of the things that's really important in his push against the culture of 1820 and his harking back to the 18th century is that 18th century poets, in best known cases, Dryden and Pope, were always eager to have a rhyming fight. You know, and I will spare the painful analogies to rap battles because I don't know anything about rap.
No, but Pope anyway, was good at that, though, as I recall.
Yes, very good at it. Yeah. And when Byron insults his Laker contemporaries, as he does in the introduction to Don Juan, which is written a little later than this, he's hoping they'll respond, but they do cold silence instead. Mm. Which is much more lethal, and which he, I think, saw as very unsporting. But they don't care about whether it's sporting. They just want to win. And they're also from much more modest backgrounds, and they are in this for the career and for life. And you don't fuck with them. You will pay for it if you do. It's weird. He harks back to the... to the 18th century in a lot of ways. And this kind of feeds into what I admit freely is my own prejudice, that something happens to England around the turn of the 19th century. Suddenly there are many brilliant engineers and brilliant scientists, but in the humanities, it's as if people got stupid in comparison to their 18th century predecessors. I mean, it's truly remarkable. You don't quite see the same thing among French intellectuals there, but then the French aren't quite as good at, you know, ruling an empire. A lot of the energies of the brightest people go into ruling that empire, and they stop putting their energy into what was called letters. None of that really matters anymore. And Byron was out of phase with that. He thought letters was still an option, and letters meant, you know, rhyming insults that people would enjoy. And
did he like Samuel Johnson at all?
I don't really know, but he does have a reference to Johnson. But I think he just describes Johnson as kind of a bummer, you know, like it makes everything less fun.
Yeah. It's a very Lamont-y reaction, right? In a way, like, no, this just kind of brings me down. It's not sort of the talent that matters. It's more like, is he with the program that I'm with or not? And yeah, I could see he wouldn't like Johnson in that way, yeah.
There's a phrase in New Zealand, and I suppose it's a phrase in Britain too, I don't know, a stirrer. It's originally a shit stirrer. Byron was a classic stirrer.
I just remember when Lamontov was in prison for those couple of years for plotting to lead a revolution. Somebody had sent him some of Welbeck's novels, I think in French, because he obviously was fluent in French. And he fucking hated Welbeck, absolutely hated him. And he hated him because he was a bummer. This is not a man of action,
I don't know. I'd try to politely disagree.
Yeah, I know. I disagree too. I just thought it was funny.
And he caused so much trouble. Oyebeck caused a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Which Lamontov would have enjoyed if he'd been in it. But yeah.
He didn't like the characters in the novels, that they're all just sort of moping around about the death of civilization and stuff. And I think that just kind of offended him in perhaps a similar way that Johnson, you know, might have offended, just his sensibilities might have
offended. Well, I think with Lamontov, it's like he doesn't like any talk of the death of something like that. It's not dead. I remember when we were talking to him, and we asked about the Russian birth rate, and he said, you know, oh, Russia, the Russian birth rate can be brought back at any point. Russians do what you tell them, and they'll have children if they're told to have children. And he was very optimistic about, I mean, he was like Jack Vance in the sense that his motto was, people are plastic as wax. You know, they can change on a dime if they're instructed to do so.
Yeah, and to your point about Lamontov and death, I mean, Thierry spoke to him not long before, Thierry Marignac spoke to Lamontov not long before he died, when he didn't really let anybody know. I guess he died of brain cancer, I think. And Thierry just told me he was furious that he was going to die. He was just angry.
That is a noble reaction.
It is, like, yeah.
I remember there's a description in Machiavelli of some Italian prince, one of his big hopes, in fact, who said, I have got everything in order. Everything is perfect, except I'm dying. It's infuriating. So the Philhellenistic movement is the result of all this ferment. The Greek exiles, the admiration for the ancient Greek culture, which it's taught with beatings to drive it home to every elite European kid or boy anyway. And so everybody wants to see Greece reestablished. Everybody imagines that the Greeks are the immediate descendants of Plato, Aristotle, etc. They have a very limited acquaintance with what is actually happening in Greece, because Greeks are actually mostly peasants barely surviving under an Ottoman regime that tolerates them at best and taxes them, and until the early 19th century, often steals their eldest sons to become janissaries. So the Greeks who foment this ideology are not even part of Greece for the most part. They're from Russia, or they're from Paris or wherever, and they don't know what's really going on. But Germans in particular are very sentimental about Greece, probably related to the fact that 19th century Germans had the best classicists. And Goethe is an early example of this, that they idealize Greeks because they think they must be the descendants of the classical Greeks. And they actually go there and die when the time comes. Most of the Philhellenes who made up the first generation, which was a very unfortunate generation, they were mostly German and some French. Not so much English, because the English had their own empire. You know, you could go into the English Empire and make your own career in the present tense, but the Germans and the French have to hark back to ancient Greece. Meanwhile, Byron first encounters, and Byron is going to be a crucial figure for this. Few English people are, until the English Navy has the final word, but Byron meets Greece in 1809. There was a tradition in the 18th century for aristocratic young men to do the Grand Tour. And by the way, the European vacation of contemporary mode is one of those habits that used to be an aristocratic habit, like keeping dogs, which has filtered down to the middle class. So very wealthy young men used to have the Grand Tour, but it began with a northerly progress. In Byron's time, 1809, the continent proper is still mostly Napoleonic hegemony. So he has to go around through Portugal and southern Europe, which are free of the French troops. So he ends up on the Greek coast, the Ionian coast, in the region of southern Albania and northern Greece, which is called Epirus. And he meets Ali Pasha, a very important figure, whom Byron idealizes. Ali Pasha is actually, he's described and romanticized in Count of Monte Cristo also, but he's a local power who shows a real ability for military strategy. And in the decaying Ottoman Empire, there are lots of these locals whose local power is enough to make them more or less independent of Constantinople. And if they are still officially servants of Constantinople, it's often when they choose, you know, when they choose. And when they don't feel like it, they can tell Constantinople to go fuck itself. So This is Byron's description of Ali Pasha when he visits him in his palace in southern Albania or northern Greece, depending. Quote, "His Highness is 60 years old, very fat, and not tall, but with a fine face, light blue eyes, and a white beard. His manner is very kind, and at the same time he possesses that dignity which I find universal among the Turks. He has the appearance of anything but his real character, for he is a remorseless tyrant, guilty of the most horrible cruelties, very brave, and so good a general that they call him the Mahometan Bonaparte." You know, it's interesting that when Byron describes him as very cruel, it's in the context of a lot of praise. You know, there's something romantic about Balkan and Ottoman cruelty. Like, ooh, those guys are cruel. Ooh, remorseless tyrants. Yeah. And Byron begins to adopt a lot of the mannerisms and the dress of the Albanians and the clefts of northern Greece and southern Albania, who are bandits but also guerrillas when it's profitable to be a guerrilla. But he doesn't quite see that. He sees it in a more idealized way. Ali Pasha is indeed cruel and dangerous, but he takes to Byron. You know, Byron was an aristocrat, and he kind of showed that, and he was snobby. And his fellow aristocrats kind of saw themselves as inclined to make friends with him as an equal. In fact, there's a great story about Byron and his little friend and probably lover and physician, Polidori. When Polidori makes a big objection to Byron's arrogance, and he says, "Well, aside from writing verses," which, by the way, is kind of a big aside, "aside from writing verses, what's better about you than about me?" And Byron says, "Well," and I imagine him saying this in a 007, just cleaning your fingernails kind of way, "Well, I can send a bullet through the keyhole of that door over there. I can swim a lake several miles wide, and I can give you a damn good thrashing." So Byron is, you know, he's not an egalitarian at all, and he makes common cause with his fellow pashas, let's say. So Ali Pasha is his first pasha, and he begins to be infatuated with what he sees as a Greek thing, but is actually a Suliot thing, which is the culture of the bandits of southern Albania and northern Greece. It's a very syncretic culture, and it's not purely Greek at all, but he sees it that way. And there is so much more reverence for Greece in European tradition than for Albania. In fact, there isn't any reverence for Albania. Whereas, you know, you're taught from boyhood to revere Greece. And this sets Byron's imagination to thinking about going to Greece. But in the meantime, this little thing happens to him called literary fame. Like, he does the grand tour, but because most people can't do it anymore, especially after the Napoleonic Wars closed the continent to English tourists, his description of this grand tour becomes a massive hit. He publishes it in a volume called Childe Harold's Pilgrimage. And I don't like it, to tell you the truth. I don't think it's very good poetry. Byron's poetry consists of either the doggerel he just wrote in his daily life, which is brilliant, or Don Juan, which is one of the great texts of the European tradition. Childe Harold's Pilgrimage is soppy and sentimental, and that's why they loved it. It's about his travels in Albania and Greece in particular, but also about Waterloo. And the character is one of those Werther-esque, unhappy for unspecified reasons, Morrissey-like youths. Only Morrissey, at least, was working class, you know. Like, in fact, I read this recent anecdote about Morrissey that his sister tells, like, she would get up first and she would start making toast. And she says Morrissey would stand behind her and he would sigh for several minutes while she made her toast. How soon is the toast? So, Childe Roland, it's a fake name, it's a fake everything, it's a fake romance, blah, blah, blah. He's tired of pleasure and revelry. He looks for distraction in foreign lands. He's always sighing. He doesn't actually kill himself like Goethe's hero, Werther, but he always feels like it. You know, just like, well, you know, Morrissey will probably die of old age at 110, but he's always going to talk about killing himself. So he mentions Ali Pasha in Childe Harold. Once again, it's not his best work, but it does bring Albania and Greece into the conversation. He says, "I talk not of mercy. I talk not of fear. He neither must know who would serve the vizier. Since the days of our prophet, the crescent ne'er saw a chief ever glorious like Ali Pasha." That's terrible. But anyway, that's what they liked. They loved it. They loved it. It was by far his most popular poem ever. Even though they had a better poem in Don Juan later on. But even if they did like it, they would only say so. Yes, I actually like it. But you know, they would never admit it in public.
This is sort of like an adventure in rhyme, I guess. Is that what it is? Like, I mean,
A fantasy adventure.
Fantasy adventure, I mean. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like Treasure Island or I don't know, something.
Yeah, it's not even what his tour was like. Mainly he made the mistake of traveling with a poor friend of his. And it was like Michael Caine says, you can't go around with ordinary civilians when you're a star. It's just too frustrating. Because Byron got very sick of his friend Hobhouse running out of money and just whining about how, no, I can't afford it. And it's like, oh, God. but he mentions the question of Greek independence in this highly sentimentalized pilgrimage through Europe. Because, remember, the British public hasn't really been able to go to Europe yet. They're too scared to go through Southern Europe like Byron did. And Northern Europe is closed off to them until basically 1815. So he describes Greece to them, and few of them actually know it. So this is all fresh. "Fair Greece, sad relic of departed worth, immortal though no more, though fallen great." That's a wonderful figure of speech, even though it's bad poetry. It's like immortal plus, though no more minus, though fallen minus, great. plus.
I know, it's weird. Yeah. Yeah, I see what you're
saying. It's a chiasmus thing. Uh-huh. Who now shall lead thy scattered children forth and long accustomed bondage uncreate? Uncreate, Byron? Mm. You want to say uncreate? Okay. Not such thy sons who whilom did await. That's W-H-I-L-O-M-E. He doesn't use that word in Don Juan, but he uses it a lot in Child Roland because he's trying to do this Keats-like, Shelley-like archaism in speech. The hopeless warriors of a willing doom in bleak Thermopylae's sepulchral strait. Oh, who that gallant spirit shall resume? Leap from Eurotas' banks and call thee from thy tomb. The Eurotas is a river in the Peloponnese, you would have to cross it, I suppose, to get to some site of immortal classical Greek battle. But again, remarkably mediocre poetry for Byron, and also perfectly, perfectly positioned to capture the imagination of the book-buying public in 1820 England. And Byron's description of that phenomenon is, I awoke one morning and found myself famous.
That's a great line.
Yeah. I mean, he was the first celebrity in a modern sense, it has been argued. I don't know if you can really, you can always go back and find some earlier historical figure for whatever phenomenon you're talking about. But at any rate, several people have argued that Byron was the first celebrity and that he set the pattern for it. Because, especially, who are you going to choose otherwise? Wordsworth, this gloomy, long-distance hiker? there were no other candidates, really. Especially, because Shelley is going to die soon, and he was sort of a candidate. But the main thing about this Childe Harold is that, one, it makes Byron famous. Two, it spreads the Greek revolutionary tradition in the European imagination. And particularly a lot of Germans volunteer for service in Greece. A lot of Germans also kill themselves because Werther killed himself. But the ones who don't volunteer for Greece because that's what Byron did. You take your choice. You can do Werther, you can do Byron. There's also the fact, by the way, that Byron was more appreciated in the rest of Europe than he was ever in Britain. They were willing to suspend moral judgment on him in a way that Britain was not. Britain only went through a Byron crisis after he was dead, after 1824, when he dies in Missolonghi. They said, maybe we shouldn't have hissed at him quite so much.
Yeah.
That happens a lot after people die.
Yes.
So Byron enters English society, and he's at first lionized and adored, but he's also quickly ostracized. He is supposedly having an affair with his half-sister. He also ruins the lives, as it's told, of several other respectable ladies, and he's less and less welcome in England. And he finally leaves his wife, Annabella, leaves England completely. He tells Annabella, take our daughter, go to your parents. I'm out of money, even though he's made a lot of money on Childe Harold. Copyright was a little fuzzy in this era, so there are a lot of pirate editions. she thinks he's gone crazy and suicidal, you know, mad, bad, and dangerous to know. She proposes a separation. Byron refuses at first. Then she says, well, you know, I don't think you want to have me write a little tell-all about, oh, you know, incest, homosexuality, sodomy. And he says, well, no, perhaps not. I'll just go abroad. And he has a legal separation from her. He leaves England, and yet he doesn't quite feel like he's the villain here. He feels like these are a bunch of whited sepulchers that are leading, in many cases, highly immoral lives. But he says, in frustration with Al Bundy, and I'm the bad guy.
Yeah.
Because he is. He's the bad guy in this story.
I mean, you can't help but see some echoes of his father there, obviously,
yeah.
Right? And it's, yeah. He got some of his dad's temperament, it seems like.
Yeah. Byron, yeah. Habits. Like the guy says in Apocalypse Now, like, wound up a little too tight for Vietnam. Definitely wound up a little too tight for proto-Victorian England. Mm. First, he goes to Italy, and he writes there the first 12 cantos of Don Juan. And that includes the dedication to Robert Southey, which is one of the most glorious products of the English language ever. But he describes Don Juan as a struggle because life for Byron in this 18th century way was fighting. And Byron said about the early cantos of Don Juan, the fifth canto is far from being the last. It is hardly the beginning. I meant to take him on the tour of Europe with a proper mixture of siege, battle, and adventure, and to make him finish as Anacharsis Clootz in the French Revolution. Anacharsis Clootz was a kind of mystical nut in the French Revolution. I meant to have him a cavalier servente in Italy, a cause of divorce in England, which, you know, is obviously autobiographical, and a sentimental Werther-faced man in Germany. So these are all sentimental variants of different European cultures. So as to show the different ridicules of society in each of these countries, and to have displayed him gradually gâté and blasé as he grew older, just, you know, jaded and indifferent, as is natural. But I had not quite fixed whether to make him end in hell or in an unhappy marriage, not knowing which would be the severest.
Little Sam Kinison there.
Yeah. So he sees the poem as a form of war, and that makes sense because he's a combat poet. And the sad thing for him is that, as I said, the Lakers only fight with little rumors or pursed lips and tisk-tisks. And Byron mourns that. He's soon going to come to real war in Greece. But first of
it's
all...
It's like when nobody would fight with Tyson anymore, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of what's going on, it seems like.
Yeah. If only Tyson had taken up poetry. Yeah. He says, oh, ye shades of Pope and Dryden, are we come to this? The trash of such sort, that is, you know, Wordsworth, not alone evades contempt, but from the bathos vast abyss floats scum-like uppermost, you know, shit floats. And these jackcades, an old rebel, of sense and song above your graves may hiss. The little boatman and his Peter Bell, that's Wordsworth poems, can sneer at him who wrote Achitophel. Achitophel is a figure in one of Dryden's poems.
Ah, okay.
So we finally have Dryden setting off for the continent, and he will never go back to Britain. His body will be, I think, moved there eventually, but long after he was dead. He always had more admirers on the continent, as I've said. And an interesting side note, I found while researching Don Juan that Tatiana Grigorievna Gnedich translated Don Juan from memory in a Stalinist labor camp.
Wow.
And published her Russian translation, which then became wildly popular, which is kind of a touching story. I haven't read
her. That's incredible. Yeah. 16,000 lines by heart.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah. But, you know, Russians seem to do that. They take memorization really seriously.
Because they take poetry seriously. Poetry still, it's probably not as alive as it was even 20 years ago, but it is still pretty alive. It's not only for, you know, highly educated experts. I mean, you start at a very young age with poetry. It is a living part of the culture. So, yeah, makes more sense.
Yeah.
And they rhyme a lot still there. You know,
yeah,
they didn't
helps,
give up on the rhyming.
I mean, it's very hard to keep the loyalty of a civilian audience if you don't rhyme.
Yeah.
I wish I'd stuck to rhyme, but that's another story. So Byron now goes to Italy, and he never moves back to what he called the moral north, and he meant it as an insult. Again, he takes up with the 21-year-old Countess Guccioli with no objection from her 57-year-old aristocratic husband. They elope to Ravenna on the Adriatic, but his wife's family are Carbonari, that is, Italian revolutionaries. The Carbonari means charcoal burners, which are some of the lowliest people in 19th century society, on the very edges of society. So they're part, that is, of a network of revolutionaries trying to unify Italy. They participate in uprisings in Italy in 1821, but those are defeated by the Habsburg army, which still controls northern Italy. And as I said, the Austrian authorities are not, you know, so much comic opera at this point. They're very serious, very grim. And they crush this uprising. Byron tries starting a revolutionary newspaper, ends up in Genoa, and is stuck with this bourgeois existence, which is very pleasant, but it doesn't satisfy his combative streak. Remember, he said to the Lakers, "I wish you'd change your lakes for ocean." And he wants to take their advice and move south toward the place where he can create a real rebellion. And the conditions in Greece are beginning to develop in a way that suggests he can do that. A lot of things happen in 1820, just as Byron is moving to southern Europe. The leadership of the Greek secret society of the Friends of Freedom, basically, Prince Alexandros Ypsilantis, is much more militant than the former leaders. He's already lost an arm fighting in the Napoleonic Wars at Dresden. His father is a Greek merchant with privileges in the Ottoman hierarchy, but fled Russia because of revolutionary propaganda, which he was spreading. So Ypsilantis becomes a Greek revolutionary. there have been Greek revolutions in the past, but they've been mostly peasant revolutions without the support of the intelligentsia, because the Greek intelligentsia is a recent creation, basically produced by the economic freedom that they enjoyed in Russia. So there is now a plan for armed rebellion in Greece against the Ottoman Empire. They're going to begin, the plan is, in the Peloponnese, that is southern Greek, the hand-shaped part of Greece that extends south from the Greek mainland, as well as the Danube principalities, and even in Constantinople, which is, as they would say in New Zealand, a big ask. And yeah, so they're getting a little ahead of themselves. But the insurrection is planned for 1821, March 25th, the Orthodox Christian Feast of the Annunciation. So we'll talk about what actually happened when things got kinetic in the next episode.
That's a great place to leave it off, which is basically right on the verge of the uprising, of the revolt, of the Greek revolt, and the launching of a very gory Greek rebellion that we'll talk about.
No combat, but lots of massacre.
Yeah.
That's, think Rwanda. That's only not quite as one-sided. It's mutual massacre.
Right. Good. Okay. That's great. I think we can end part two of the Warnerd series on Lord Byron here, and looking forward to part three, the war.
Things get kinetic.
Yeah, things get kinetic. All right. Thanks a lot, John. And
thanks everybody.
Everybody, Brendan, and talk to you soon. Bye.